Hello and welcome to Nightcap with Jim. I'm the titular Jim, and tonight we'll be continuing our three-part series on the Mission Impossible franchise. For more content you may enjoy, please check out our Morning Mugami podcast and our other social media content at Mugami Players on Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, and YouTube. Let's get into it. Alright, so we begin this episode, of course, with Mission Impossible 3, directed by J.J. Abrams. Pretty dope cast, I gotta say. One of the best, for sure, in the series. We got Michelle Monaghan playing Ethan Hunt's love interest wife in the film, and Philip Seymour Hoffman as our villain, along with Billy Crudup, Maggie Q as our Mission Impossible girl for the movie, and Lawrence Fishburne, and of course the introduction of Simon Pegg's character Benji, which is so awesome. So it's interesting. Apparently, Ricky Gervais was actually supposed to play that particular part, but pulled out of the movie and was actually replaced by Simon Pegg, which is just like, you know, another one of these things that happened, you know, with the Mission Impossible franchise. It's just like, yes, so glad that that happened. I mean, I love Ricky Gervais, he's awesome, but I think we can all agree that we love Simon Pegg's Benji. I think we can all agree that, because he just does an amazing job with the role, and it's just, you know, it's just awesome. So we get some pretty fun like trivia stuff on this one, which is really interesting, but we'll get to that in a minute. So let's go over the basic story. So this one, Ethan Hunt, he's out of the spy game. He still works for IMF, but as a training officer, and he's, you know, celebrating his life with his new spouse, played by Michelle Monaghan, named Julia. And so, you know, everything's good in his life right now. You know, he's out of the field. He's, you know, he's just training new agents, and, you know, he's in love very deeply. And then all of a sudden, Billy Crudup's character, he shows up. And he's like, hey, you know that the only recruit to pass pass muster for actual field work, yeah, she's in a spot of bother. So we kind of would like it if you go help her out. This character, Lindsay, is played by the wonderful Carrie Russell. She's just an amazing actress, and it's actually a little bit surprising, because her role in the movie is not very big. And for them to get someone of her caliber for such a small role is a pretty big coup, you know? So that's just awesome. You know, I love Carrie Russell. She's amazing. The main villain of this, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, named Davian. He's trying to get his hands on this thing called the rabbit's foot, and, interesting, you know, is this, like, it's how vague this thing is. Like, nobody really knows what the rabbit's foot is, what it does. So that's pretty cool, because there's this definite, like, sense of kind of dread, about it, because it could be anything, you know, at any time. And if you want to know what it is, you have to watch to the end of the movie. no spoilers. But yeah, you never really know what it is. So it could just be whatever it could be. You know, it could be anything. It could be, you know, some sort of like a nuclear trigger, or it could be some kind of a biological weapon, or it could be like a tech bomb, you know, or anything. It could just be anything, you know, and so throughout the movie, there's this sense of, I mean, for me anyway, this sense of dread of what is this thing. And Simon Pegg's character Benji, he addresses this issue at one of the earlier scenes in the movie before you know, stuff really gets out of hand. And he talks about this professor that he had. Whenever he sees someone willing to pay, this kind of money, which Davian's character, he's paying $850 million for this thing. He says whenever he sees a group willing to pay this kind of money for something, he always assumes it's some kind of end of the world kind of stuff. So there's definitely that going on, which is pretty scary. And the movie opens up with, one of the most dramatic openings of the series, and it's a torture sequence, and Ethan Hunt is being tortured, and Julia is kind of the victim of this torture as well. Like, she's the one who's actually physically being tortured, with Ethan Hunt having to watch watch this. And that's a very despicable but effective manner of torture in a way, because you're not inflicting pain on the person you want information from, which, someone like Ethan Hunt, a world-class super spy, could resist because they've been trained to do that. But when you're talking about someone that they care about very deeply, that is something that is much more difficult to combat when you're in that situation. So very, very dark, very intense, very, very, opening that really gets you into it real quick. And just, it just right off the bat, even though we flash back in the movie, because this is the opening scene is a flash forward to the third act, it definitely sets the tone for the villain as someone who does not mess around. He's definitely not someone to trifle with, and so that's the nice thing about it, is we get to meet him before we actually meet him, and that's a very effective tool if done correctly, because when we finally meet him 50 minutes into the movie, we're already like, oh, this is a bad dude, and we need to take this guy seriously. Some pretty amazing stuff that they do. So they filmed in Rome. With this sequence being set in Vatican City. Pretty sure they didn't actually get to film in Vatican City, though. I think that's a bit of a tough thing. And while they were filming in Rome, this is interesting, they actually were just swarmed with people wanting to watch them film, so they came up with this kind of a clever idea. They came up with a fake second unit, and they had women in bikinis, women dressed as nuns, and, were pretending to film takes of the movie so that they could actually get their work done, which is a pretty interesting, pretty clever idea for, getting some nosy fans, giving them the slip. But that's J.J. Abrams for you. He's a pretty clever guy. One of the reasons that he got this movie is just because of that, of how he can, creatively problem solve. And, Tom Cruise has been, bringing people in to the franchise because he likes their work on certain things. And you really can see the faith that Tom Cruise has in the people that he wants to bring in, especially in this case with J.J. Abrams, with this movie having a $150 million budget, which makes it, at that time, and I think that record might still stand to this day, the largest budget for a first-time director. Giving $150 million to a guy who's never made a movie before is a pretty ballsy move, but, J.J. somehow was able to do it. And, that definitely, he was definitely able to accomplish that because of the faith that, Tom Cruise and the production company had in his abilities. Again, Tom Cruise doing a lot of his own stunts, pretty much all of them. Now, this is the first movie where we get the big stunt. The one big death defying stunt that is just like so crazy. But because again, this is JJ's first time, and you know, just way too difficult because it hadn't been done in the series yet. So you know, there's this very big, stunt is Ethan Hunt jumping off the roof of one building with a wire and using that as a fulcrum to swing onto the rooftop of an adjacent building. Now they did do this practically, but not on location in Shanghai, off the roof of a skyscraper to the roof of another skyscraper, because that just wasn't feasible for one reason or another. And so what they did is they did it on a soundstage using green screen, but Tom Cruise really did jump off of a facade that was 7 stories high, so that's 70 feet. And that's still pretty insane, you know. And I mean, we're talking about, you know, running full speed and jumping off of this thing. And that's still pretty dangerous, even when you're working in an environment that you can control completely. So, you know, this is the first movie really where we start seeing Tom Cruise getting some injuries, and he got some cracked ribs. But also a special effects technician named Stephen Wheatley. Oh my God, excuse me. Special effects technician named Stephen Wheatley ended up suing Paramount and Tom Cruise's production company for a pyrotechnic stunt that went wrong, and he ended up being engulfed in a ball of fire and suffered third degree burns to 60% of his body. So, you know, this stuff can be dangerous, you know, if it's not done right. And you know, you just gotta be careful when you're doing these kind of big crazy action sequences, because stuff can go wrong and people can get hurt. A little interesting tidbit, a little side note, the sequence. So in the first movie, the disguises with the masks, the infiltrator was unable to speak, and then in movie 2 we get vocal print gadget introduced so that the infiltrator can 100% become whoever they're pretending to be. And in this movie we get how they attain the other person, the person that they're trying to be's voice. And it's a poem by Neil Whitman, and it was written to just include all the sounds of the English language known as phonemes? I don't know. I should probably have looked up the pronunciation of that word. I'm usually pretty good at pronunciations, but this one's giving me the runaround. But yeah, it just has all the different sounds of the English language in there, so that they can, you know, create the vocal print. So that's cool. I really enjoy when they add little stuff like that into franchises, you know, when it comes to like gadgetry or some sort of science, you know, just like this is how this gets done. So that's really cool, because it makes you think about stuff, at least me, it does. And then finally, for publicity on the film, Paramount rigged 4,500 random Los Angeles Times vending boxes to play the theme song, but a lot of these would malfunction, and some of them would, you know, fall from from their little hidey spot, and would be mistaken for bombs. And so, you know, you got bomb squads detonating, you know, a number of these vending boxes, and even, you know, getting to the point of shutting down a veterans hospital because of these things. But Paramount decided to keep them in use until 2 days after the film's release. So, an interesting, you know, a bit of you know, advertising a movie. I'm not sure if that was the smartest idea in the world, but they did, you know. but you know, this is a really cool movie. It's you know, it's the second lowest rated after or before Mission Impossible 2. I enjoy it. You know, it's not my favorite, but it's still pretty good. Some of the stuff I'm not so hot about is just, I mean, JJ has a very distinct visual style, and I'm not sure that his particular visual style was the right fit for the Mission Impossible franchise. Now, he's a great director. I love what he does. I love his work on Star Trek. I love his work on Star Wars Force Awakens, and you know, JJ is really interesting because this is the first of three franchises that he rebooted. Because he did this one and brought Mission Impossible back after, you know, the 5-year hiatus. So, and then, you know, he brought back the Star Trek with Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness, and then he brought back Star Wars with Force Awakens. So, you know, he's very, very interesting career he's had, you know, and he does a great job directing. It's just, like, I kind of wish that he would have modified his visual style a little bit to suit the franchise a little bit more, because the rest of the franchise, you know, with the exception of this movie and Mission Impossible 1, all have a pretty similar look and a vibe about them. But this one and the first movie are kind of the outliers that, you know, don't really conform to the visual style that the rest of the franchise has. And, you know, to be fair, you know, we're talking about a lot of different directors. You know, Brian De Palma is definitely not the kind of guy you'd think would, you know, work on the same franchise as a John Woo or a J.J. Abrams or a Brad Bird or a Christopher McQuarrie. So, you know, it's just interesting stuff. But beyond just like some of the little bit of the visual quirks, and when I say that, I mean mostly the nighttime stuff. Like the daytime stuff is fine for the most part, but there's just little things about the visuals that you know, don't kind of jibe with me in terms of just the overall look of the franchise. But anyway, that's going to wrap it up for Mission Impossible 3. Stay tuned. We're going to be right back to talk about Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. Stay tuned.
Hey, Nightcap listeners, this is Heath from Morning Mungami, the podcast that you want to listen to start your day off right. Currently, we're doing a 3-part series where me and the Mungami players sit down and we talk about the film genre mockumentaries, so you're not going to want to miss that. Tune in Fridays, 8 a.m. Eastern Time, only at Mungami Players, and I mean, it's the best morning show in the world. Why would you want to miss it?
And we're back to talk about Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. Now, really quick before I get into this stuff, I just have to say this movie was definitely my favorite of the Mission Impossible franchise when it came out. And I just love it so much. It's just so awesome. but anyway, this time we got Brad Bird in the director's chair. And so we have two movies in a row that are directorial debuts in one way or another. Brad Bird, for those of you who are film aficionados like myself, will recognize his name from the credits of movies like The Incredibles and The Incredibles 2, as well as a little film with George Clooney that didn't do so hot. but he's great, dude. He's such a great director. So excellent visually. You know, he's just got a really great eye for stuff, and that definitely comes across in this, his first live action feature film. Another great cast. That's one of the things about the Mission Impossible franchise is they know how to put together really good casts. So our Mission Impossible girl for this, or Mission Impossible woman for this movie is Paula Patton playing the role of Jane Carter. Our villain, played by Michael Nyquist, you might recognize from the first John Wick movie. Jeremy Renner, of course, as Brant. And we got Josh Holloway in the mix. And, you know, a bunch of other great, great actors and whatnot. It's just so good. Like, this movie is just really, really, really well put together. I heard telepathically, you guys, from my first episode, just going, wait a minute, Ghost Protocol, much like, the first movie only has three big set pieces as well, doesn't it, Jim? Mission Impossible 3 is also similar, isn't it, Jim? Well, yes, but there's a lot more action, a lot more stuff, you know, to keep it going, keep it rolling, so it doesn't drag, you know. So this one, we start in Moscow, and the Moscow sequence is pretty long, because we go from, you know, meeting Ethan Hunt in prison, to the break-in of the Kremlin, to his escape, to him and his team's escape from Moscow, and traveling to Abu Dhabi. And then we have the massive Abu Dhabi sequence, which includes the big stunt of the movie, which is Tom Cruise hanging off the side of the Burj Khalifa, the tallest building in the world at that time. I mean, Tom Cruise is just fucking insane, man. I don't know what it is, like, where he got balls so big that he's like, yeah, I'm going to hang off the side of a building. You know, or in the previous film, yeah, I'm going to jump off of a 70-foot facade. You know, for movies. I mean, like, I love the guy. I mean, like, literally the only person who's as insane in the world as Tom Cruise is Jackie Chan. And, you know, I mean, I could do a whole series just on the stunts of Jackie Chan, you know, because he's just absolutely insane as well. And Tom Cruise is definitely just as insane. I mean, this guy's hanging off the side of the world's tallest building. I mean, he's 1,500 feet in the air. And who does that? I mean, who? Oh, God. And then we go from from Abu Dhabi to the Act 3 climax in India. I'm sorry. Like, because I watch as I do before I review or before I talk about movies on the podcast, I like to watch them the night before or the day of before I start recording. And last night was the first time I've watched Ghost Protocol since probably since before Rogue Nation came out. And I was just laughing, like, for the entire movie. Just at, like, the absurdity of some of the stunts that were happening, you know, just because they're just so ridiculous. I mean, this movie, like, every Mission Impossible like ups the ante. You know, just every time is just bigger, better, badder, and that doesn't always work, but with Mission Impossible, it definitely does, because it's Mission Impossible, you know, they have to find a way to make the mission more impossible, than it was last time, and that's what I love about this franchise in particular, is that, that's what they literally just out of necessity for the fact that the title of the films are Mission Impossible, you know, they have to make them insanely difficult, you know, to the point where they're impossible. So, you know, so they just keep on getting bigger and bigger. All right, so this is interesting because Brad Bird directed it, and he's, you know, from Pixar, so we have a couple Pixar references creeping their way into the Mission Impossible universe, which is fun. And if you don't know what the references I'm talking about A113. So there are two of them in this. There's the ring that Josh Holloway's character wears to deliver the little tranquilizer dose to the target, his target, for the opening mission that goes terribly wrong and sets off this whole course of this whole chain of events. And when Tom Cruise, when Ethan Hunt calls in to get a pickup after he's escaped after the this escaped the hospital after the Kremlin bombing, and his code number is Alpha 113. Now this is a reference to the California Institute of Arts room number for the character animation program, which I think is really cool that you know that they've kept that, you know, reference to, you know, where like just where they come from, you know, like that's what me and my people that went to college, you know, I started calling us the 620 mob because that's the address of our dorm where we all met, and you know, we probably might not have all come together the way that we did if we all didn't live in the same place and you know, and on the same floor and come together the way we did to do some of the projects that we did together, like Dorm Zombies and stuff. So, you know, it's nice. It's just really nice. It's really sweet to, you know, for that Pixar, you know, it's like they always remember, you know, they remember where they came from. Some really cool, some kind of little fun little tidbits, like and a nice throwback to the original television program, which is the screen hologram that they use when they're infiltrating the Kremlin, also showed up in the TV show in season 4, episode 16, The Falcon Part 3. So that's fun, you know, that they like, you know, I like, that's what I love about franchises, or that's what that's one of the things I love when franchises do, is when they, you know, throw back to to, you know, stuff that's happened previous, or you know, stuff from whatever source material, if there is source material. We also get a Max reference with Dunhill and the lighter, and even a replica of the mask that they put on that they put on Ethan Hunt in the first movie when he's going to meet Max. So that's really cool. And this is actually the first film. There's actually two firsts. Well, actually three firsts, I guess I should say. There's the first time directorial debut of a live-action film. This is the first film not to have current or former IMF agents as a or the villain of the movie. And it's the only film up until this point. From what I understand, in Fallout as well, for the heroes not to wear the masks. So that's some fun little stuff for you there. And something really interesting, and I don't know if this is actually going to carry through because of Jeremy Renner's absence from Mission Impossible Fallout, but the Brant character was apparently created to replace Ethan Hunt when Tom Cruise decides to step away from the franchise, which, I mean, I don't see that happening anytime soon. I really hope it doesn't. You know, I mean, I think he can go until he's, you know, in his 60s. I mean, the guy's in great shape and he's out of his goddamn mind. So, you know, I think he could keep going for, I think we can get another two or three missions out of Tom and Ethan before they finally decide to hang up their hat collectively. This movie is just, again, though, it's just so insane, you know, some of the just ridiculous stunts, you know, But just also just really great stuff. Like, I just love the way this movie flows together. And you know, like, the way that it starts with the opening of the tail end of this opening operation with Josh Holloway and the team, and then transitioning into you know, Ethan Hunt in this Russian gulag, and then busting him out. And you know, I just love that Benji, you know, has become, you know, such a pivotal character over, you know, the course of his time in the films, because he's just one of my favorite characters, if not my favorite, in the entire franchise. You know, I just absolutely adore Benji. You know, I mean, I'm a huge Simon Pegg fan, so that definitely that definitely has a, you know, I'm a little bit biased. But yeah, it's just incredible, you know. And I love this opening, this sequence in the prison with this song being used to kick off this escape, and you know, him having to be in this certain location by the end of the song. And the song choice is one of my favorite songs of all time, and I might get a little bit of shit for it because it's, you know, it's definitely one of like the most popular songs of this particular artist, and it's Ain't That a Kick in the Head by Dean Martin. And I just adore that song. You know, I love it so much. I just love it to death. It's definitely one of those songs that you could just put on at any time, and I'm going to start singing along. You know, I'm going to start crooning right along with Dean Martin to it, because it's just such a dope song. And then, you know, just this great choreography of fight sequences in the prison. And then this really super clever way of infiltrating the Kremlin. So dangerous, because it's just like, oh, we're going into the Kremlin. Okay. and, you know, like, you really get how dangerous that is when you see Tom Cruise's, well, Ethan Hunt's reaction to this mission briefing. I mean, the guy's broken into the CIA headquarters in Langley, for crying out loud, but breaking into the Kremlin is the one that's like, really? I'm gonna do that? Okay. So, you know, you really understand, like, just how crazy of an idea that is. Especially because, you know, I mean, there are two very different locations to the Kremlin and the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. You know, I mean, the Kremlin is right there in the city, at least, you know, in terms of the geography of the film, and, you know, has, you know, tourists and visitors walking around outside and stuff like that. Whereas CIA headquarters in Langley is, you know, all out there in the middle of the woods by itself. You know, this high-tech building that's just in the middle of nowhere, basically. So, you know, it's two very different things, and it's just like, you know, it just really kind of makes you think a little bit about infiltration. Like, if you were a spy, like, just like, what would I do if I was going to try and break into a place like this? It's like, I would not want to be a super spy, man. It seems like a tough gig. but yeah, and then this amazing Dubai sequence, you know, where just one thing after another goes wrong. And that's one of the things that, you know, really appeals to me about this film, especially, you know, with its inclusion in the Mission Impossible franchise, is that this is like one of the first times where it's just like really an impossible mission, because every single thing goes wrong constantly, you know, with the exception of the prison break. That goes over without a hitch for the most part, you know, but this opening mission with Josh Holloway and Paula Patton and Simon Pegg trying to get, you know, the nuclear launch codes, that goes wrong. You know, they infiltrate the Kremlin, that goes wrong. You know, Ethan escapes from the hospital, gets picked up by the secretary and Brandt, and then that goes wrong. You know, they get to Dubai, and you know, just one thing after another goes wrong. So they can't break into the server room from inside. They have to, Ethan Hunt has to scale the side of the building, you know. And then the gloves that he's using to climb don't work. And then, you know, and then he can't get back down. So then he uses this tether thing to go back down. But it's not long enough, so he's got to jump. And then he jumps and he misses his mark a little bit and almost plummets to his death. You know, the masks, the mask machine fails. just one thing after another, just everything going wrong, but somehow they find a way to pull forward and try and, you know, fix the situation. But it just, throughout the entire movie, everything they come up with, every plan, something goes wrong and they have to alter the plan or change the plan, come up with a new plan. And it's just, you know, I just love it so much because it's really Mission Impossible, you know. Like, this is, like, I think, you know, the first true impossible mission. You know, the rest have been pretty damn tough. But this is the first one where it's just like, geez, is there any way another thing can go wrong? That's kind of what it feels like these guys were doing when they're coming up with the story and writing the script and stuff. It's just like, can we have another thing go wrong? Okay, cool. Can we have two more things go wrong? How about five more things? Let's have five more things go wrong. You know what? Let's have another four things go wrong after that five, and then let's have another six things go wrong after that four, after that five. and that's great. I love it, you know, because it's definitely Mission Impossible. That's gonna be our show for tonight. Thank you. I love Ghost Protocol. thank you so much for listening. Please tune into our morning show with Heath and check out our other social media content at Mungami Players on Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, and YouTube. Thanks again so much for stopping by for a nightcap. Good night.